I don't have to tell you what's going on outside, and I'm talking about the weather. You know that it is springtime. I don't remember all of that old poem that spring has sprung, the grass has riz, I wonder where the flowers is, and something about they a bovine ilk, the one in moo, the other milk, but there's an old poem like that that talks about springtime. To a lot of people, it's the favorite time of the year, and I've got to say that I'm one of those, because it is a time when new life is everywhere. The other day, I was being shown the little tiny ducklings about that big, and I've got to be sure to take my grandchildren now out in my golf cart and show them, because here was a mother duck that came up to the actual golf tee where people were, because the ducks have been fed out there and they're used to it, and here trundling along behind her with these little 1.5-inch long furry golden little balls with little tiny beaks and their little webbed feet, just as cute as they can be. My wife and I have been treated to springtime by looking out of our backyard window at the bluebird house that is on our fence and watching the parents. First I looked in, there were 5 eggs, and we watched them feeding the babies. The little yellow beaks are like so many little tulips opening up in there. And I would go out, they would hear me, they're all stretching their little necks out expecting me to give them an insect. And you watch the parents. Well, on the weekend that we were gone over there to Kentucky, they flew the coop. They had pledged and they were gone. And we looked very carefully in the trap in the pool, because we have had birds that tried to swim when they didn't know how. But this year, none of that. So they escaped and they're all happily twittering around in the trees somewhere. We have an enormous number of different kinds of birds there where we live. I actually tried to write them all down this morning, and I probably didn't get them all, but we've got bluebirds, mockingbirds, blackbirds, starlings, grackles, robins, jays, tree sparrows, English sparrows, barn swallows, scissor-tailed swallows, cardinals, house finches, golden finches, red-capped finches, tree creepers, red-headed woodpeckers, downy woodpeckers, pileated woodpeckers, flickers, chimney sweeps, doves, and every now and then we'll see a great blue heron or a hawk or some other big bird like an unwanted crow that will fly by. But they're all right now nesting and reproducing. And of course, my peach tree has little bitty green peaches that are barely beginning to show up. We didn't have very many blossoms this year, but I enjoy taking a cup of coffee. My wife and I get out invariably if the weather lets us, and we take a little walk in the backyard. This morning I was staring at our black gum, and the first little green leaves were just beginning to show up on our black gum tree. So it's a time of new life, and it makes me think about the holy day season coming up. And I began talking to my wife this morning about an analogy, a comparison I had never really thought of before, never zeroed in on before, that the passing seasons are like our lifetimes in many ways. Because when we are born, and for the first few years of our life, it is the springtime of our life. We are new life. We have never been before. We are brand new. We are learning all of those things that we're supposed to learn, how to behave like civilized human beings and not do those things anymore once we're 5. And so I would say that the springtime of our life is from birth to about age 6, 7, or 8. And then the late spring is from that time until perhaps 13. And then middle spring toward early summer is in our teens to our 20s when we blossom. And that's when young girls blossom. Men, you know, boys do not mature anywhere near as early as girls do. When you see the prom season, you will see these, some of them are creeps, some are ginks, some are tweebs, dweebs, jerks, and otherwise. And you see these long, gangly, knobby boys with huge, big black Stetsons and big black boots and all kinds of funny-looking clothing, and they are ushering on their arm into the restaurants around Tyler some of the most absolutely delightfully beautiful young girls you've ever seen in their splendiferous gowns. And every year, it's a kind of a ritual. The girls look mature. They look like they're, you know, 25 or 30. The boy looked like they're 16 with zits on their face. And it's really funny. I've noticed it year after year that girls seem to blossom and mature a lot earlier than men. Men seem to mature in their early 30s to mid-30s. Maybe that's why men generally tend to marry girls who are younger than they are. I don't know, because the girls have to wait for the boys to grow up. In our own case, I was 23, my wife was 17, so that's not necessarily the best example, but Abraham set an example like that, I imagine. So having said that, if you go on through the seasons, early middle age, we mature from about 36 to 50. I don't think we mature really much before that. Maybe some people think they do, but I know by the time I was 36, I was amazed at how stupid I must have been when I was about 30. And when I was 50, I was amazed at how stupid I was when I was 36. Later middle age, 50s to 60s, or early old age, if you want to call it that, is kind of like late summer. And then last February 9th, I entered the autumn of my life. I got to be 70. And I will characterize 70 to maybe 85 as autumn. Now, I know that at 85 has got to be winter. And autumn, you notice, is the time when things begin to drop. Everything kind of falls. Hair falls, your cheeks kind of drop, your waist kind of sags, and everything kind of begins to fall down a little bit. And not quite springing forth, but sort of falling back. It's kind of like daylight savings time. So that just happens to us. Now, I know that we've only been allotted our 70, and people are living a lot longer today, but I think if you will look at the seasonal cycles that God has put in nature, that you will see a pattern there that is easily analogous to human life as well as to God's annual holy day seasons. The festival of the Passover and the Days of Unleavened Bread is calculated by counting from the vernal equinox, from the first day of Abib, to the 10th when they set aside the lamb, to the 14th at even when they sacrificed it. And notice what we're dealing with here. The way the high priest determined whether or not it was the first month of God's sacred year was to do two things. First, he had to look into the field to find out if the barley was in the ear, because the very meaning of the month when God revealed it to them was the month of green ears. So spring was springing forth. And because there were two harvest seasons in that temperate climate, the Mediterranean kind of a climate on the Maritime Plain down below Jerusalem, which is quite high in the mountains, and they had a spring harvest and a fall harvest. So when a farmer who maybe had X number of acres, if you were a wheat farmer, barley farmer, oat farmer, and you walked out into your field and you looked as the spring rains began to come and the days were getting a little bit longer and there were little green shoots and then finally a stem and finally a stalk, and then you looked and it was earing up and you saw these little tiny delicate beginning hints of grain that was forming on the end of a stalk, you would be very happy and very blessed indeed. And you would say, honey, I think we're going to have a great crop this year. Looks like the weather's cooperating. The hail didn't beat it down to the ground. And root rust and stem rust and root rot and nematodes haven't got us. And we got a great crop coming up. And you'd be very happy because you would think you're going to have a bountiful harvest. So the high priest had to see, is the barley in the ear? If he saw this as a new moon coming on, the observable new moon, the beginning cycle of the moon, and the barley wasn't in the ear, then even though he thought that it's probably time that it ought to be the month of Abib, because he'd been counting new moons from the last one and from the seventh month when they observed the Feast of Tabernacles, he would say, no, this is not the month of Abib this year. It's going to come a little later because the seasons varied. So it could not have been, contrary to what some people think who like to be professed biblical scholars and scholars of the calendar and to work out why some people are keeping holy days at the wrong time, cannot be worked out by a computer model at all because the seasons vary. So if the new moon and the eared grain was already visible, the barley was in the ear, then that was the new moon of Abib, or later on when they came back from Babylonian captivity, they called it Nisan, or the first month of the sacred year. Then they began counting the days. Now notice the accoutrements that went along with that first Passover. Let's go to Exodus, the 12th chapter. The Eternal spoke unto Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, saying, this month, and I have a little marginal reference, it says Abib or Nisan. And Abib means green ears. Ears of what? Ears of barley. So man is told to look down beneath his waist, to his feet, to the ground under his feet, and to observe whether or not there is food, the staff of life, food that man can use, not only to make grain and therefore to make bread, to make gruel and cereals, but also to allow to ferment, turn it into mash, and produce out of it different kinds of beverages. This month, Abib, shall be unto you the beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year to you. Now, what is a year? Well, you know that a year is the distance that the sun travels, basically, in 365 days around the sun. And a day is measured how? Well, by the earth turning once on its axis. So time is space, and space is time. Distance and space, the distance that the earth travels around the sun. The moon traveling around the earth as the earth travels around the sun. And the solar-lunar calendar is not exact because a lunar month is not exactly the same. It is not either 30 or 31 or 29 days. It is totally different than the solar year. And therefore, God gave the annual holy days and set it according to the seasons, which can vary. And the Hebrews have kept track of that calendar. You can look it up and see it in the 11th edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica or the Hebrew Encyclopedia, the Jewish Encyclopedia, under Article Calendar. And there's a great deal of information available on it. This day shall be in the tenth of this month, rather, verse 3, they shall take to them every man a lamb. Well, what do you know? They weren't to give up their bicycle or their tricycle. They weren't to give up their spare tires. They weren't to give their old tractor or their car. It was an agrarian society. So once again, God points to the land and to living creatures, a lamb, which is a brand new little sheep, which has just been dropped and is brand new and is probably being fed now. It is only a matter of weeks or a month or so of age. And for some reason, God started it that way. Man and woman were created in a mature environment, just like our lives, when we are mature in the autumn of our lives, in early middle age. So man was placed in a mature garden with mature plants, herbs, roots, all kinds of shrubs, berry vines, trees with fruits and nuts on them. Everything for man's food was there at hand. He could pull it out of the ground. He could pluck it from a shrub or a bush. He could pick it from a tree. And it was right in that harvest season when mature, full-blown, totally mature, male and female were created by Almighty God. Now, you cannot apply the question to any of the evolutionists that is so obvious in all of this because they just don't know how to answer it. Which came first, the spermatozoon in the egg, or the little fetus in the womb, or the human being? Which came first, the chrysalis or the butterfly, or the egg that it lays, or the little grub or chrysalis that begins to form, or the butterfly which emerges? Which came first, the fly or the maggot? Which came first, the chicken or the egg? Which came first, male or female? There are no answers to that short of absolute divine fiat and a beginning of creation at the mature time of autumn when everything that was ready to be harvested was there for man's food. And then why is it that all the little calves and the little kids and the little lambs and all the little ducklings and the tiny little birds are brought forth in the early spring? Well, that's because they have all of the summer. They have the bounty of the new growing things. The insects are just rife right now because of the warm weather, flying everywhere. So the minute the little tiny bird, if it's a ground feeder like a robin, pecks its way out of the egg, it follows its mother and it lands down as it's beginning to fledge and fly. Its mother's been feeding it until that time. And as you know, a robin is a ground feeder. And so a robin, which has the most acute hearing of any creature I've ever seen, is able to actually hear a worm slither. Unbelievable. I have seen robins with big, noisy lawn mowers going by on the golf course and in my yard. Only yards away from a lawn mower, and that robin is going like that, takes about three hops and grabs a worm and pulls it out of the ground. I heard the worms slither. Because it's able to completely cut out the sound of that stupid lawnmower and to listen to a worm. Now, I couldn't hear a worm slither if it were slithering in my ear. I would say there's a worm in my ear, but only because I felt it, not because I could hear it slither. But they can hear insects crawling on the ground, and they go and they get them. Now, right now, insects are everywhere. I've already got the chimney sweeps in a chimney. They're flying around and grabbing insects out of the air. We got barn swallows under the bridge. They're grabbing insects out of the air. I got the scissor-tailed swallows. They feed on the ground. They perch, they see, and they fly down and get it. also have red-headed woodpeckers that defy evolution because I've seen them fly out of a tree, land in the middle of a green, and grab a grasshopper. Now, if they will do that and they will feed on the ground, it means that they never needed to peck the bark of a big hickory or an oak tree in the first place, which means that there was no requirement for them to develop that tremendous ability, which means that there aren't any woodpeckers, because the first time a woodpecker tried that, he bent his beak, broke his neck, probably fell over backward and died, and there aren't any woodpeckers today. But that's another subject, and I won't launch into that. Mark has a pileated woodpecker around his house. You know how big they are. They're almost as big as a small crow. And they've got a kind of a crest in the back, and they will really take... I saw one trying to build a nest in our condominium down at Jekyll Island one time. And he was whacking pieces of board off of the coping below that roof, about as big as I could have, with a small hatchet. Bang, bang, and big chips flying. Anyway, enough of that. Plenty of food around for them, and the little calves can suckle and nurse and then begin to eat grass, and of course they are dropped in the early spring, so they have all the summer to get ready. I actually had a question. A lady wrote to me not long ago, and I had to write her back. I think I did, and we got the letter out. If not, it's still in a tape somewhere. But she wanted to know, how could it have been that man had to plant seed and wait all of those months for it to come out of the ground, because he would have starved to death? And it couldn't seem to come to the natural conclusion, which is obvious, that Adam and Eve were placed in the middle of the garden in the autumn, in the fall. So here God points them to the land, to the ear of grain, and to the little lamb, and it shall be a lamb for each house. If the household be too little for the lamb, let him and his neighbor next unto his house take it according to the number of the souls, every man according to his eating. Isn't that interesting? According to his eating. In the 23rd chapter of Leviticus, and I won't turn to that, it says, these are the feasts of the eternal. And every feast is a festival where there is something to be imbibed, something to be eaten, with the exception of one where it's the opposite, where you do not eat and you fast. But every one of them has something to do with the human appetite, with the human mouth, with human survival, with human life. And in all of this, if you read all of that 23rd chapter of Leviticus, you will read that every single one of the offerings were offerings from the ground. There was not one single offering there that was holy and sacred to God, which said, you shall give your jewelry, you shall give a fine violin, you shall present to me a tapestry, you shall give to me your latest invention. No, every single one of them were bullocks, lambs, kids of the goats. They were little doves. They were meal, and it said ground fine, and in some cases mixed with oil. Now, any housewife knows when you put oil with fine ground flour, you're about to make dough, and you're going to make cakes, and you're going to cook with it. So fine oil, wine, meal, and the produce of the land is what God required in those sacrifices. Why do you suppose that is? If you'll keep your place here, I want to go back to the book of Acts, the 17th chapter. You know, even the pagans knew where life came from. And in their own way, they were stupidly trying to worship the source of all life. They were trying to celebrate life, but they didn't know how. And here was a group of people that when Paul saw them, and the entire city just was worshiping every kind of a statue, some kind of an icon, some kind of an altar, an idol. It said in verse 16, his spirit was stirred in him, and he was in Athens, they call it Atene over there, when he saw the city wholly given to idolatry. Therefore, he disputed in the synagogue with the Jews. I don't know how many of you have ever really studied Greek mythology or Roman or pagan mythology, but the so-called gods did all sorts of horrible things, but it was basically simply the grossest of human appetites that were being pursued by these so-called gods. They were hunters. They were rapists. They fought wars. They were prodigious drunkards like Bacchus, and the symbol of his festival was wine and drunkenness and so on. So the orgies were all justified by this worship of pagan, non-existent gods that were figments of the imagination of the Greeks and Romans, and long before them the Babylonians. and all had to do with food and drink and the cornucopia, horn of plenty, of the outpouring of all of the produce of the land and the imbibing of it in prodigious quantities by human beings who were wont to overdo it and to get completely drunk, or to turn around and just empty their stomachs in a trough, which was known in the Roman orgies, and turn around and wipe their face and eat again. That would be a pretty horrible thing to have to watch, but that's what they did. They just went to every extreme you can imagine. Verse 17, therefore, he disputed in the synagogue with the Jews and with the devout persons and in the market daily with them that met with him. Now that's kind of a public forum, isn't it? I've never done that. I'm thankful I've never had to. I don't know that I'm required to do that. But the Apostle Paul certainly did. When I would go to England, my wife and I would always see somebody on his soapbox out there in one of the wonderful big parks like Hyde Park or Hyde Park Corner, Marble Arch, and there he'd be out there. Small little group here and small little group over there, and some guy standing on a soapbox, waving his hand in the air, preaching away. It was entertainment for a lot of people. You see people with their baby buggies stop and listen for a while. Some idiot over there propounding some kind of a stupid theory of one kind or another. And he just went out and began to preach, began to shout on a street corner, and people would stop and begin to listen. Well, this was not like that, but people would ask questions, and then a group would gather. Then certain philosophers of the Epicureans, now these were the fast livers, this was the wine, woman, song group, and of the Stoics, and that's the opposite, these were abstemious, encountered him, and some said, well, what will this babbler say? That shows the contempt and, of course, the vanity that they had. He seemeth to be, some said, a setter forth of strange gods, because he preached unto them Jesus and the resurrection. They'd never heard of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, never heard about the resurrection of the dead. And they took him and brought him unto Areopagus. Now, this is the court of the Areopagites, as it says in a margin. And saying, we would like to know this new doctrine whereof you speak. What is it all about? Because you bring certain strange thing to our ears, we would therefore know what these things mean. And it says, for the Athenians and strangers were those who spent their time in nothing else but either to tell or to hear some new thing. They just loved new theories. Then Paul stood in the midst of Mars Hill and said, you men of Athens, I perceive that in all things you are most religious. The margin says religious. Now, you can look at this in two ways. You can say that Paul was putting them down, and he was saying, I can see that you're too superstitious, and so on, and take that course. But I don't think Paul did, because I think he was trying to open their minds and trying to get yes answers and trying to win them over. And I think the way you can get yourself killed is to engage in idol bashing. And I think right then and there, Paul knew he could have been taken out and crucified or stoned to death or stabbed with a spear or something if he enraged that group of people. And that wasn't what he was trying to do. For as I passed by and beheld your devotions, that's a kind way to put it, the gods are in the margin, I found an altar with this inscription. So he seized upon their own religion. To the unknown God, whom therefore you ignorantly worship. Obviously, the word ignorantly merely means because it was unknown, it means that you don't know. And as I've said, what you don't know that you don't know it. He was not putting them down. He was saying, whom you are trying to worship, whom you don't know, the one that you acknowledge ignorance concerning, you don't know this God, that God is the one I declare unto you. Notice what he says. God that made the world and all things therein, seeing he is the Lord of heaven and earth, dwelleth not in temples made with hands, neither is worshipped with men's hands, as though he needeth anything. Now the inference there is, of course, worship by the artisan with his chisel making a statue. But you could also make the point that he is not worshipped by doing this, meaning putting your hands together in a steeple, or by doing this to people, which does no good except show off your ring, making little funny signs with your hands like that. You may as well just go like that or like that, because, you know, goodbye cruel world, the proverbial chain, and the guy sitting in the bowl and he's about to pull it anyway. It doesn't do any good to make funny signs with your hands. God is not impressed. He's not impressed with a human attitude of body. He's not impressed with the way we sit or stand or walk. He's not impressed with the way we do our hands one way or the other. He's not worshipped with men's hands as though he needeth anything, seeing he gives to all life and breath and all things, and have made of one blood, and science didn't learn that until fairly recently, that the blood supply, which is by and large polluted and very, very short now, and they say that up to 20% of the blood supply in the world is polluted with HIV. But if it were pure blood, it wouldn't matter from which race it came, that there are certain blood types, O and A and whatever, and that these types are common to every race. So it is true that the Word of God says that God made us of one blood, all nations of men, for to dwell on the face of the earth, and has determined the times before appointed and the bounds of their habitation, that they should seek the Lord, if haply they might feel after him and find him, though he be not far from every one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being. As certain also of your own poets have said, for we are also his offspring. No, he wasn't trying to enrage that audience. He was using their own innocent but ignorant attempt to try to find the one God or some God or other, and in so doing, looking at life and looking at nature and looking at all the creatures of this earth and the sea, the boy on the dolphin, etc., and making all kinds of statues to them and trying to cover all the bases. And the Apostle Paul is trying to get their attention and to elucidate and to illuminate and to get a yes answer and to open their minds to the truth of God. He's not trying to get them angry enough to want to kill him. So he quotes from their own poetry, their own literature, which shows that he was familiar with it. He was well read. He was well educated. For as much then as we are the offspring of God, so he seizes on what their own literature has said and puts out before them an obvious point of truth, which we know from the Word of God, that God made Adam and Eve, and we are God's offspring. We ought not to think that the Godhead is like unto gold or silver or stone graven by art and man's device. And the times of this ignorance God winked at. He allowed it. He's not angry at you right now. You know, you've been sincerely trying, but hey, it's time now to grow up. You were trying before, but now let's get down to brass tacks here. But now commandeth all men everywhere to repent, because he has appointed a day in the which he will judge the world in righteousness by that man whom he has ordained, whereof he has given assurance unto all men, in that he has raised him from the dead. Now when they heard that, they began to mock. This is only a fraction of what was said, obviously. It's a synopsis by Luke of what was said at that moment. Paul may have gone on and elaborated at some great extent about Jesus Christ, about his miracles, his ministry, about his death, about the fact that Paul had seen him, about his appearances, about the other disciples' experiences in actually seeing him disappear through a stone wall. And a lot of them stayed and listened, and some drifted away, and some caucused and began saying, I think he's an idiot, let's get back and worship at Artemis or Diana or the Ephesians or something. But it said, certain men clave unto him, verse 34, and believed, among which was Dionysius the Areopagite. So one of the leaders of that sect was converted there, began to believe. A woman named Damaris and others with them. There were some converts out of that big disputation right up there on the top of Mars Hill. Interestingly, every time one of God's servants begins to tell the unconverted and the uninformed about God, they point to him as the creator and the giver of all life. When I was in my mother's womb, the only source of my life came out of my middle. And my mother, in partaking of air, food, and water, and digesting it, was able through her bloodstream, not now a bird picking up insects and putting it either regurgitated or whole down the gaping maw of its little baby in the nest, but a mother who is eating, processing, digesting, causing her bloodstream to feed the baby through the umbilical cord, right? That's where I got my oxygen. I had lungs, but I wasn't using them. We were all in the same condition. Now, right now, think of your nostrils as your umbilical. We are all breathing the same air. Hopefully, no one here is so contagious they're going to give all the rest of us some terrible disease. Because probably a little while ago, part of the air you just got through breathing had already been processed by somebody else. It had been in their lungs. But then there's air coming in. It's leaking in through all the cracks, and it's coming in under the door, and there may be a fan, maybe some air conditioning. But every time you fill your lungs, you're like that baby attached to its mother's source of supply through the umbilical. In him we live and move and have our being. If God did not have a big envelope of these mixtures of gases, of the hydrogen and nitrogen and carbon dioxide and all the others, but especially that precious oxygen that our lungs are able to take out of that air and to expel carbon dioxide so the plants can synthesize the carbon dioxide and give off more oxygen, including diatoms in the sea, so that it's a fantastic process, almost like a living, operating piece of machinery where it is cyclical and like the perpetual motion machine. If we did not give off the carbon dioxide, the plants could not synthesize it. If they didn't have sunshine, if they didn't have rain, they didn't have the earth, they wouldn't even exist in the first place. If they couldn't be giving off oxygen, we could not survive. But daily we go about our lives and we're absolutely unaware that literally every beat of our heart and every breath of air we breathe comes from God. Man had nothing to do with it except our mother and father, according to the pattern God put in nature, produced us. And from that time on, we are hooked on air and food and water, and we can't get along without it. We live according to that. Now, back to the 12th chapter of the book of Exodus. Notice how he went on to say that that lamb was to be without blemish, verse 5. It was to be absolutely perfect, a male of the first year. My friend Delmer Jeske joined the 4-H, and even though we lived in the town environment, we were on the outskirts of town and for a time outside the corporate limits of Eugene, Oregon, and he had a fairly large backyard, and he had a little tiny lamb, and he was raising it. And I actually got to go and hold that little lamb and to give it a bottle. And that little lamb nursed at that bottle in the same way that a human baby would. And he would curry it. And that was the cutest little thing. It would have been unthinkable for anyone to kill that little lamb and eat it, because it was like a member of the family. The little lamb would follow him around. Everywhere that Mary went, the lamb was sure to go. You've heard that. But this was true. They will. When you raise an animal like that as a pet, they will follow you all around. Now, I am going to tell you a terrible story. I may have told you that before. It's in the chapter of a book that I've written. I have yet to get published. But I remember being a Pied Piper, and Pied Pipers are sometimes not trustworthy. And my uncle and my grandmother had actually ordered from what they called monkey wards, and it came delivered by an old 1924 truck, I think, a box. And in that box, little holes around, I heard a peeping sound. Well, Grandma took the cover off of the box, and lo and behold, I think most of them or all of them had survived. Here were a bunch of little yellow chickies, little chickens. And she prepared a little pen, a little house to keep them out of the rain and everything. It was just a place in the grass area in a walnut orchard, and put them in there. And she would feed them grain and everything. But also, they were allowed to peck and to forage. And so on an occasion, I would go out and let them out of their pen, and I would walk over to the walkways. And the walkways were merely boards that were put down in that Oregon soil. And I would pick up one of those big old boards. All the little chickens had run under there. And I mean, it was just filled with everything from sow bugs to worms. And they're pecking happily and busily away. It got to the point to where when they saw me coming, they would begin to follow me, and they would follow me. And so I led them all over that whole barnyard, even an old cow chip. I'd pick it up, and they'd run under and grab everything that was there. A rock, a piece of machinery, anything that was lying on the soil, an old tire, I'd pick it up, and they'd run under it, and they'd get it. Well, pretty soon we ran out of worms and bugs. There was nothing else that I had picked up that I hadn't picked up already, until I spied this huge, big 55-gallon oil drum. Well, it had rained, I guess, the day before, and there was still a bunch of water in the top of the rim, and it had grease on it. It was all rusty, and I was a little kid. I don't know if I was 9 or 10 or 11 or how old I was at the time. Never forgotten it. I decided those chickens would really find a feast under there. So with great, you know, struggling, I grabbed that thing, and I pulled it like this, and I was holding it like that, and a bunch of the chickens ran under, and about that time, it slipped out of my grasp and went on the ground with a sickening sound. I was desperately afraid to look underneath that oil drum. I made a quick count, kind of broke out in a sweat. It looked to me like the group had been seriously diminished. And so I went and they followed me along, and I was able to get them back into that pen and close that little fence, that little gate, little wire gate, and put them in there. Well, I didn't close it real good, and I guess it was milk time that afternoon when a bobtail cat — Dwight had about five or six cats, there were several cats around the barn — was seen running frantically with one of those little chickens, which was now getting those little white feathers and growing up a little bit to the pullet stage, in its mouth. And Dwight performed an execution the following day with a .22. He called that cat up to him, and the cat just looked at him like that, and he shot it right between the eyes. And so I just let the cat take the blame for what had happened. I figured that Dwight had assumed that that cat had been feeding on those chickens for quite some time. And I never did inform him otherwise. Now, Grandma has long since died at age 96, reading her Bible, and just went to sleep in her favorite chair. And my Uncle Dwight died probably 15 or so years ago. And I never did inform either one of them about what happened to those chickens. So it's safe for me to tell the story now. But it was between me and the cat, and between you and me, it would have been the cat every time. I was not going to tell Dwight that I was the one that had caused the decimation of that flock. But some Pied Pipers you can't trust, as I said. But nevertheless, getting back to the subject here, little life like that, very, very precious. And I was delighted with those little chickies, and I was just sickened. I was just absolutely destroyed. I never could get rid of that, and I still feel guilty about it today. It was kind of funny in the telling, but I do feel bad for those little chickens. The cat had nine. The little chickens only had one, you know, so they were gone. But I notice if I'm reading through this, the lamb shall be without blemish, a male of the first year. You take it from the sheep or from the goats. Could be a kid, remember. Could be a kid as well as a lamb. And keep it until the 14th day of the same month, and the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill it in the evening, and they shall take of the blood, and strike it on the two side posts and on the upper door post of the houses wherein they shall eat it. And they shall eat the flesh in that night, roast with fire, and unleavened bread, and with bitter herbs shall they eat it. Eat not of it raw, nor boiled or sodden with water, but roast, like barbecued over a turning spit. His head with his legs and with the pertinence thereof. And you shall let nothing of it remain until the morning, and that which remaineth of it until the morning you shall burn with fire. So it was to be a feast. They were to eat the whole kid or the entire lamb till it was all gone. Anything left over they were to consume with fire. And thus shall you eat it. Isn't it interesting all the way through this? And I want to turn back now to the 23rd chapter of the book of Leviticus. You will see eating and feasting, and that the things that they were to eat were to come from the ground, from their flocks and herds, and from that which they produced. Now, beginning in chapter 23, verse 4, these are the feasts of the Eternal. The feasts of the Eternal are mentioned in verse 1, and the Sabbath, by the way, is one of God's feasts because it's included in verse 3. Verse 4, these are the feasts of the Eternal. A feast is a feast. It is a repast. It is a meal. It is an elaborate dinner. It's not a snack. It's not fast food. It is something that takes time to prepare. It is like a banquet, virtually. These are the banquets of God, you might say. This is the repast of God. This is the wonderful, full, seven-course meal that God has provided. Even holy convocations, which you shall proclaim in their seasons. In the 14th day of the first month, at even, is the Eternal's Passover. And on the 15th day of the seventh month, the same month, I'm sorry, is the Feast of Unleavened Bread unto the Eternal. 7 days you must eat. There it is again. Eat unleavened bread. You eat the lamb. You eat the bread. You feast. Time and again, talking about the Feast of Tabernacles, he said that you should spend the money if you convert it and take it in your hand, because the way is too far for you, because it was an agrarian society and they were people of herds and orchards and farmers and so on. So they couldn't always take their produce and dried fruits and nuts and things like that and journey to Jerusalem or the place where the Feast of Tabernacles was held. If the way be too long for thee, you can sell it, convert it into money and take it in your hand, and there you shall spend it. Whatsoever your soul lusteth after. Well, the original Hebrew word means earnestly desire. But that's real desire. When you get to the Feast of Tabernacles, you think, you know, I haven't eaten out very often this year. I'm really looking forward to a great, maybe filet mignon and a bottle of imported French Chateauneuf du Pape wine. Because people don't normally allow themselves that kind of pleasure during the course of the year. And that's what he's talking about, a feast. In the first day you shall have an holy convocation. You shall do no servile work therein. But you shall offer an offering made by fire unto the Eternal 7 days. Now, what were those offerings? Verse 10. Speak unto the children of Israel and say, when you come into the land which I give unto you, you shall reap the harvest thereof. That was the barley harvest. And you shall bring a sheaf of the first fruits of your harvest unto the priest. Look at the annual holy days. The Passover featured a slain lamb which was eaten together with unleavened bread. Now the Lord's Supper is coming, the night of what we have traditionally called the Passover, but really it's a New Testament Lord's Supper, which most churches refer to as communion. And what do you do at communion or the Lord's Supper? You eat a wafer of unleavened bread. You drink a tiny little cup of wine. You imbibe it. You take it into your stomach and you digest it. It becomes a part of you. That's a part of the ceremony. Christ said that his body was the bread that he would give, and the wine is the blood of Christ which was shed. So the bread that we eat pictures his broken body, not broken, the bones were not broken, but he said, which is broken for you, meaning that the flesh was broken open, and he was very sadly and horribly beaten. And we eat that. Interesting, isn't it, when you think about it? That in the annual holy days of God, as they progress through the seasons, we are eating, with the exception of one, when we're fasting, because it has a completely different connotation. The days of unleavened bread, for 7 days, 7 days shall you eat. 7 days you shall eat, you shall imbibe, you take into your mouth, you chew up, and you make it a part of you. What do you eat? Unleavened bread. What is bread? Bread is the staff of life. There are nations all over the earth, pagan nations as well as modern nations, that actually featured a shock of wheat on a part of their national seal. States in the United States have grains or sheaves of grain like oats or barley or wheat in their state seal. Many nations would have bread and the symbol of bread, that is the grain from which it comes, as their national banner or their shield or their flag. Now, I've told you before that the Spanish word or the Latin word P-A-N, pan, comes from the pagan concept of pan, who is supposed to be everywhere, you know, they pan this and pan that. Panorama is a 360-degree view, pan-American and so on. You know what the word pan means. But from that, they take the word that we apply to the little flat skillet that we use, and they call it a pan because it was the implement made out of iron originally on which they cooked a cake. And so they call it a cake made in a pan, which is a pancake. Well, it actually goes all the way back to the fact that bread is the staff of life, and it was, instead of the maker of the grain, instead of the designer of the barley, the wheat, and the oats being worshipped, the barley, the wheat, and the oats themselves were worshipped. And the pagans looked to the thing instead of the maker of the thing. They looked to that which was there in nature and to nature itself instead of to the God who designed it all. And through the annual holy days, we are eating. Now, what is the next annual holy day that comes along? It is called in the Bible the Feast of First Fruits, isn't it? Pentecost, the Feast of First Fruits. That's what it was originally called. And that is the spring harvest, of which the early barley harvest was only a precursor. But a little later on came the real bountiful harvest, and the Feast of First Fruits depicts God harvesting from the earth the first fruits unto his growing, expanding family, those who were converted. Look what he tells us to do during the Feast of Tabernacles, to bestow upon us everything, including tirosh, which is the Hebrew word that means not yayin, which is wine, but literally means liquor, and that's absolutely provable by looking up the meaning of the Hebrew word. That during the Feast of Tabernacles, you can even, and you can any other time you want to, as long as we don't do it in excess. There are sins that are sins in any amount, and there are sins that are sins in excess. And Christ was not called a wine bibber because he never touched a drop of wine. He actually did drink wine, and he gave wine to them on the occasion of the Lord's Supper. So even the regulations about how to prepare the food and the kinds of food that would be prepared and the kinds of beverages that would accompany it are made here in connection with everything from the Passover right on through to the Feast of Tabernacles. Continually he said, you shall eat. These are the feasts of the Eternal. Now notice in verse 37, talking again about the Feast of Tabernacles and summarizing it, these are the feasts of the Eternal, which you shall proclaim to be holy convocations, to offer an offering made by fire unto the Eternal. What was it that they burnt? Well, it wasn't their jewelry, wasn't artifacts, it wasn't implements or instruments, it wasn't copper or iron lids or pans or objects that they made with their hands, but it was a meat offering, a sacrifice, and drink offerings upon every day, beside the Sabbaths of the Eternal, and beside your gifts, and beside all your vows, and beside all your free will offerings, which you give to the Eternal, but they were to offer the produce of the land, a lamb or a kid, finely ground meal, the best of the meal that they could obtain, and oil and wine continually. God told them to do that. I find it fascinating as I look at my life and I look at the life cycle of human beings. I know now that I am past the summer of my life. I know that many of us are in the late spring. I know that my children, grandchildren, are in the spring of their lives. Some of them are now, one of them is getting to the very beginning, perhaps, of late spring or early summer. Many of you are in the summer of your lives, some late summer and some early autumn. I am probably now in late autumn, and I do not deceive myself that I'm going to be really filled with all kinds of energy and just going around at great guns and doing great things 30 years from now. I don't think God has promised that I will live to be 100. When I founded the Church of God International back in 1978, I had no idea what would occur. I really thought that I was camped out and I'd be back with my father probably within a few months, and that he would certainly come to his senses and he would see what was happening around him and we would be reunited. I had no idea that it would consume up to 21 years to build that church to where it was, nor could I have foreseen what occurred. Now as I look and I think about the future and I think about the past, I realize I don't have 21 years to try to build a church or an infrastructure. That is not my goal. I am in the beginning of winter. My hair is the color of winter. It's the color of Jack Frost, you know, and of snow in the field. They say they take colors and they tell you about the kind of colors you're supposed to wear, and sure enough, I'm a winter. That's what they say. I cannot wear rusts and ochres and browns very well. I'm supposed to wear black and blue, like a black eye, and all that. So, no, there isn't going to be that much time, and that's not our goal. But as I look at the rapid development of global communications, I look at this internet, I look at some fantastic breakthrough that I'll begin giving you a little later on, going to occur now, of the time, probably in the not-too-distant future, when I can be standing here like this anywhere, here in Tyler, and for a very small amount of money, literally millions of people can be listening to me live at the same time through a digital camera, beaming up to a satellite and coming right down into their homes for very small cost. We don't need to think that we need decades to build a mailing list and to have a gigantic physical plant and all kinds of infrastructure in order to do the work of God and to proclaim a witness and a warning to this world. Now back to my analogy, we know that when winter comes in nature, the fall precedes it, and things begin to fall. As I mentioned, the leaves fall, and they die. The grass turns brown, and it dies. But there is a dormant character to those trees and to the roots that are in the soil. They, in animal kingdom, begin to hibernate, or they estivate, or they wait until the snows melt, and then the little bear cubs come out of the den. So as I was going out this morning and saw the first three little tiny green leaves on my black gum, it's a little later than our sweet gum and the other trees, we were thinking about that and I was talking about it at home. So it is with the human life cycle. When we die, not all of us dies. We are only dormant. There is coming a resurrection. There is coming the first resurrection when the dead in Christ will rise first, And the rest of the dead lived not again until the 1,000 years were finished, it says in Revelation 20 and verse 5. So whoever it is who has ever lived or died, just like those trees that appear to be naked of their leaves, and they appear to be so cold in the wind and the sleet of winter, or covered with snow, and even snow clinging to their naked branches if they're a deciduous tree in the middle of a dead winter. When springtime comes and the sun begins to warm the clime again, and all life begins to bud and to shoot forth, and the little ducklings hatch, and the little birds are feeding their babies, and the leaves begin to appear on the trees, so in the cycle of human life that Almighty God has placed in His great plan, which is pictured by the seasonal progression and the rotation through the seasons every single year of His annual holy days, the plan of God, the purpose of God, why are we here, where are we going? We are to be born of God and become a member of His kingdom. When we die, we are only dormant. There is coming a springtime of life, and I want to close by looking at a couple of scriptures, Malachi 4, 1 and 2. Behold, the day cometh that shall burn as an oven, and all the proud, yea, and all that do wickedly shall be stubble. And the day that cometh shall burn them up, said the Eternal of hosts, and it shall leave them neither root nor branch. But unto you that fear my name shall the Sun of Righteousness, this is S-U-N, characterizing Christ as the dawning sun warming the earth, and He is coming in the strength of the sun, shall the Sun of Righteousness arise with healing in His wings, and you shall go forth and grow up as calves of the stall. And what is a little calf but new life that is brought in from the field and protected in the stall and nurtured and fed? In Revelation 1 and 13 through 16, the picture that John saw of Jesus Christ in His glorified state, in the midst of the seven candlesticks, one like unto the Son of Man, clothed with a garment down to the foot, and girt about the paps with a golden girdle. His head and his hairs were white like wool, as white as snow, and his eyes were as a flame of fire, and his feet like unto fine brass, as if they burned in a furnace, and his voice is the sound of many waters. And he had in his right hand seven stars, and out of his mouth went a sharp two-edged sword, and his countenance was as the sun shineth in its strength. And in Revelation 21, 23 to 25, or 22 to 25, I saw no temple therein. John sees the vision of the holy city. And he says, the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are in the temple of it, or are the temple of it. And the city had no need of the sun, neither of the moon to shine in it. For the glory of God did lighten it, and the Lamb is the light thereof. The Savior of the world is depicted both in the Old Testament and even these New Testament prophecies as that little tender lamb that can be held in one's arms, that is absolutely innocent, that is perfectly pure, that is not a predator, but an herbivore, that is a beautiful little animal, and of course was the lamb that was sacrificed at the Passover time. The lamb that was slain from the foundation of the earth. He's spoken of as the lamb in the book of Revelation many times. The lamb is the light thereof, and the nations of them which are saved shall walk in the light of it, and the kings of the earth do bring their glory and honor into it. And the gates of it shall not be shut at all by day, for there shall be no night there. God's priests, feast days, His annual holy days, are a celebration of life and the meaning of it, an acknowledgement of the source of our lives, not just the creation, but the Creator, and the purpose of our lives. The Passover that is coming up is a celebration of exemption, of exception, of forbearance, of redemption, of forgiveness, of a passing over of the sentence of death, and therefore a great celebration of freedom and liberty. Freedom from death, freedom from sin, liberty from every kind of oppression, whether moral, mental, political, spiritual, military, whatever, release, liberty, captives going free, freedom. And how was that done? Anciently, it was done by eating, by having a feast, by eating roast lamb and unleavened bread. As I was thinking about this and just thinking about life, I had to think again, who makes all of this? When I go home, if this evening I have a little glass of my very beautiful Cabernet Sauvignon, which I got from California, my wife and I have held it up and looked at it even outside of the sun shining through, and I've invariably said, man didn't produce that color. Man didn't make that wine. God did. Man did not design those grapes. Man didn't make those grapes grow, but God did. And all man had to do is to just pluck the grapes from the vine once they're ready, and then squeeze them and let the juice be conducted and carried into a vat, and then take the grape skins and everything that gradually accumulates on the top of it and simply skim it off. And eventually, after it is fermented, which is a God-ordained natural process, just drain that liquid that is the most beautiful ruby color into the vessel that you intend to keep it in. And there it is. God made it. So it's interesting to me that God caused lambs and fine meal and wine and oil that comes from the olive that can be crushed out of various substances like wheat germ oil or olive oil. And that those were the things that he demanded be given to him in sacrifice during what he calls the seven annual feasts of God. Let's all have a marvelous Passover season. Think about our lives. Think about the temporality of them. And think about what happens when we die. It's only like those trees in our yard when they only go dormant for a little while, and soon it will be springtime.